This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Word for Word across Australia on your community radio network, coming to you from Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson with you. And when it comes to the personification of Aussie masculinity, the hyper macho man amongst men, I can think of no greater cliche than our Aussie rules footballer. And you only have to look at the grand final, the ultimate war of two tribes in battle to the bitter end, no matter how many weeks that takes, as the final frontier.
So how is it that when you have so many men in the one spot or on the one team, at the exclusion of women, homosexuality does not manifest? How is it that in the era of the metrosexual, a softening of masculinity, our football warriors are seemingly threatened by the mere thought of a homosexual amongst their ranks?
Today's guest knows firsthand what it is like to experience homophobia in the sporting ranks. In 1993, when he came out as a coach, his team experienced overt and institutionalised homophobia, and one of his athletes was brutally beaten by a football player.
He has written dozens of books on masculinity, sport and homophobia, and he is here in Melbourne as the keynote speaker at the World's Football Conference examining the triumphs, trials and traumas experienced around gender and sexuality in sport. Joining us word for word is Dr. Eric Anderson. Welcome.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Sue. Pleasure to be here.
You have written quite an amount, haven't you? You've been quite a busy lad.
Indeed I have, yes.
And it's based on your personal experiences.
Yeah, sometimes I think the best academics are those who study what's personal to them. And I was simply a high school coach and a high school cross-country, high school teacher and a high school cross-country coach. And after coming out of the closet and experiencing the homophobia you discussed, it redirected my life.
Okay, well, let's take you right back.
I
call it my radio black couch.
Okay.
You're growing up, obviously, you've got an accent there, so you're...
From California.
You're a California boy, so let's talk about that. So you were growing up young male.
Indeed.
And sexuality, puberty.
I always knew I was gay. From the time I was very young, probably 6 or 7 years old. In fact, I remember the opening day of Star Wars in 1977. I was checking out a boy a few seats over and a couple aisles down, thinking, man, he's cute. But then I turned to my mom and I said, Mom, I want my hair cut like his. And I realized now what I was doing. I was passing. At the age of 9, I knew not only that I was gay, but I knew that by staring at another boy for too long, it was socially unacceptable, and I had to come up with a reason for it.
How did you know at that time? I mean, a 9-year-old doesn't really have the vocab at that point or understand the whole gender specifics, relationships, masculinity,
or what
sort of
is
stuff.
Right and wrong.
Indeed. Well, we don't necessarily have the vocabulary at the time, although I think today's youth actually do have the vocabulary. I'm working with 5-year-olds right now, and they understand what gay is. Or at least they understand it in terms of a coupled relationship. They may not understand it in terms of sex, but they understand it in terms of two men or two women together is a gay couple.
When I was 5, I was labelled a poof in school, my first day at primary school. And I had to ask a girl what a poof was, and she told me that it was someone who eats worms and maggots. So that's what I thought a poof
was. She just got the letter wrong on maggots.
Yes, good point. So what you're saying is that the kids now do have a language that,
yes.
but often that's a negative aspect as to what
gay.
A homosexual word is. Yeah. Mm. We have a language here amongst our students. It's so gay, meaning it's bad or it's yuck or it's wrong.
That's a Western worldwide phenomena. It's so gay to mean something that's lacking in character or something displeasurable. But the youth have the ability to understand that the word has two different meanings. So many of our words do have two different meanings. In fact, so many of our words have different meanings only by the connotation in which they're spoken. They clearly understand that there is, oh, God, that test was so gay, versus, hey, my friend is gay. And to them, this is not an issue. And when adults tell them that you shouldn't say that's so gay because it's homophobic, they say, well, no, it's not.
Eric, I imagine that when you were growing up, because you became a coach, that you must have been yourself reasonably good at sport.
We'd hope so.
No. No, quite the opposite.
You were just good at teaching sport.
I was the worst in all of the combative sports, all of the football and anything that required motor control at all. I was absolutely horrible at. But what I could do is I could run.
Now, so that's an individual sport. And I wanted to talk indeed. A little later about the difference between team sports and individual sports and coming out, because it seems that there seems to be more people happy to come out in an individual sport than there are in a team sport.
We'll get to that, hopefully.
We'll get to
yes.
that, yeah. But so your sporting prowess, limited as it, yes. as it was, certainly threw you amongst the ranks of other sporting elite.
Well, you have to remember that.
You had an attraction to it, clearly.
It was actually an escape, okay. because in America, high school kids are required to participate in PE, and the notion of PE isn't recreation and physical fitness. It's bashing your skulls together in American football or soccer or some other sort of team sport. And I was trying to escape that, and so I went out for the cross-country team where I didn't have to participate in any of that. And it's important to remember that the type of masculinities that sport produced, particularly back in the mid-1980s, was very much so hierarchical, and it still is today, of course, by the type of sport you play. So the sport I was in, cross-country running, well, we weren't the coolest on the block, now were we? We were a few steps above the musicians and the theater
right.
people.
Right? Okay.
But, we weren't...
You weren't the all-American football jock.
Because we do have that stereotyped picture of the American football, the high school jock system, the arts. It's not that far polar apart from the Australian.
It's so similar to our system here.
But I think the American system seems to be a lot harsher, a lot more distinct in that there is that jock system, whereas our footballers are a bit bogan-ish, they're kind of whereas the Americans, it's more I'm fabulous.
What Sue's trying to say is that there's a socioeconomic class structure amongst our football students that seems to be less middle class than what it is in the US.
Now, your football, when you refer to football, of course, you're referring to
Australian rules,
rules.
Rugby, right?
No.
Phones are ringing right. hot now.
Yes.
Aussie rules football.
I think, in each country, there's different masculinities to different sports.
Mm.
In America, the premier, without a doubt, it's American football, and there's nothing that comes close. You do have other sports in this country that come close. What we would call soccer isn't exactly, what we would call a wussy sport, is it?
No, it's not.
So,
although
but we don't have helmets on. That's how tough we are.
Here it is considered, amongst the footballers,
crowd.
It's considered the most weak of all of the footballing codes.
So I guess what's important to understand is there's different sports, and your participation in that sport is culturally specific to how masculinized that sport is. What's important, and what I'm sure we'll get to soon enough with my research, is that things are changing. And that's what's really important to understand.
All right. So I'm going back to the couch and working towards
yes,
the things
yeah,
that are changing.
We have ways to go, don't we?
I know. We have a little way to go. But so you're growing up in high school. You knew you were gay.
Yes.
Did you have relationships at school?
No. In fact, I didn't come out of the closet until I was, shockingly, 25 years of age.
That's okay. I was 40. We don't talk about that though. So you've
She's
gone
still
through.
In therapy.
I'm still in therapy. Hence my couch. So you've gone through high school. I don't know the high school and then university.
Yes, I went through high school at the most homophobic period of American history. Well, in modern history.
This is what I want to get the picture of homophobia
yeah.
in your high school.
The 1980s in both the United States and England, and I'm sure that the data would show it's the same in Australia. I have no reason to believe it'd be anything otherwise. Was that the 1980s, the mid-1980s, we experienced a peak in homophobia. And this was really for three reasons.
Is this the Reagan years?
Yes, the Reagan-Thatcher years.
Okay.
And that's the primary reason, was a return to conservative politics. The second reason was AIDS and AIDS phobia. Mm. What AIDS did is it brought homosexuality literally out of the closet. It went from back in 1895 when Oscar Wilde was convicted of posing as a sodomite, not even being gay, but just posing as being gay. But when he was convicted, he represented homosexuality in an extremely flamboyant manner for men. Of course, homosexuality didn't exist for women back then. The Queen of England said women would never do such a thing.
Outwardly.
Yeah, exactly. And so for men, the portrayal was this extremely effeminate, flamboyant male. And what that did for a number of decades, it gave most gay men, or a number of gay men, some protection. Because if they didn't act like Oscar Wilde, then they weren't perceived to be as gay. The 1980s changed all of that because, quote, normal American men and normal British men and Australian men were dying in normal families. And we had Rock Hudson dying of HIV, you know, dying of AIDS. And so it brought homosexuality out of the closet. And essentially, now everybody knew that anybody could be gay. And this, about 1984, is a pivotal moment in our culture.
But what that didn't do was embrace it.
No,
it actually did the opposite.
No, absolutely not, which is, back then, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And so it made us all the more homophobic. And the reason it made us more homophobic is really it made us more homohysteric. And when I say that, what I mean is straight men cannot and have not been able to in the past and still cannot today, straight men cannot prove they're straight. It's impossible for a heterosexual male to prove that they're straight.
But they go hell over high water to do it each and every day.
That's exactly it. To prove and reprove and prove and reprove. And it's a never-ending task for them. Now, I come out and I say I'm gay, and nobody doubts me. Everybody, oh, of course you are. If you say you're gay, you are. Nobody says, well, maybe you're closeted hetero, right? So we know that even the most masculine men, you know, Tom Cruise is thought to be gay by many, you know, and this is a guy who flies jets and plays masculine volleyball on the beach and
jumps
marries Nicole
cliffs.
Kidman. And yes, you know, and yes. And so your heterosexuality can be dinged with just one false action. It can be negated by one small sexual behavior, by one thought, by one anything. So what this did in the mid-1980s was created a culture of extreme homophobia, extreme hypermasculinity, and extreme homohysteria, where men were running around pointing fingers at each other saying, we know somebody's got to be gay. It ain't me. Look how masculine I am. Look how macho I am. It must be that more feminine, thinner guy. So back in the 80s,
softer spoken,
smaller muscles,
better dressed.
I was just going to say neatly dressed.
Yes, absolutely.
So what happens through the evolution? We've got that in the mid 80s, and yet now we have this this culture, if you like, of the metrosexual.
Brilliant, isn't it?
Which is kind of the absolute reverse.
Yes.
We have men that are quite comfortable going to the beauty therapist to have their waxing done, that wouldn't be seen dead without going to the hairdresser every 4 weeks. And yet they're 100% heterosexual.
Indeed. And this is mostly what I study. I began my career as an academic in the late 90s studying openly gay male athletes and how they experience homophobia. And what I found was that from the time I came out in 1993 to the time I started doing my doctoral research in the late 90s, that times had changed enough where openly gay athletes were coming out and they were being accepted by their teammates, and they weren't having the horror stories that I was used to having, that I was used to hearing. And things have only gotten better ever since. And as homophobia has dropped, and as straight men have said to themselves, I don't really care if people think I'm gay. I don't care if I dress in gay ways or act in gay ways or do stereotype gay things, then it's given them more freedom to do it. And of course, the more men who have done it, well, that opens up a vessel for even more and more men to do it. And now these things are losing their stereotype as being gay. So dressing well isn't a gay thing anymore.
In fact, the metrosexual man who is comfortable in his heterosexuality isn't threatened by being called a homosexual.
Absolutely.
It's water
not.
Off a duck's back because he's comfortable with his heterosexuality.
Indeed.
Why is it then we have environments like Aussie rules football, which are so inherently and entrenched in their masculinity? In fact, they're the only situation I can think of where it is an all-male environment where homosexuality doesn't permeate. You look at prisons, you look at the Navy, you look at any other environment where men are together for a prolonged period of time, and homosexuality exists. Whether it's talked about or not, it exists.
Right. You might be kind of jumping ahead because we've got some time to fill between the 80s and
I know,
where
he does
now.
That. It's really disappointing, isn't it?
And it's really good stuff, and I've got some really good answers for you.
Thank
but
you.
Do you want to lose all of your listeners in the first 10 minutes?
No. Please.
I'll take you right back to the point again. He tends to do this, and then I just tend to shake my head.
He's the kind of guy that flips to the book and reads the last pages first.
Right? Yeah. That's
right. Actually, he does, and then he tells you the ending. Right, on that point, this is word for word across Australia on your community radio network. Talking to us today is Dr. Eric Anderson about homophobia in sport.
We'll be back with more shortly.
Now, we are talking about homophobia in sport, and I am Kate taking control again. The lesbian takes control. And I want to go, we've talked about the 80s and the homophobia around the 80s, and we're talking about the AIDS bringing all the fear into, into the general society. What about the 90s? Let's talk about the 90s. Did things change much from the 80s to the 90s?
Well, I'm going to back you up by giving one more point about the 80s.
Oh, now it's...
Sorry about that. Need to do it. Need to place us in the proper context. The 1980s were the most homophobic period in Western history because of the political backlash, because of AIDS, but also because church attendance began to drop in the pews. And in
why
church,
did that manifest as being homophobic?
This is a kind of a brilliant analysis.
Okay.
I'm about to pat myself on the back for this one.
Okay.
As church attendance began to drop in the pews, churches found a new way of making money was to pipe church into their living rooms through cable television.
Right.
But unlike the pews where you pass the hat or the bucket or whatever heck, whatever they do in church, and there's some peer pressure to put some money in by your neighbors who are witnessing you, there's no such pressure in the living room. So what they do is they find a whipping boy, and we became the whipping boy. Donate money to us, and we will fight homosexuality. The homosexuals are taking over the family. They're taking over the world. You know,
they're destroying our culture as we know it.
All of that crap, right? Right. So you had those three reasons that made the mid-1980s the most homophobic period of time. And since 1988, there's been a gradual reduction in cultural homophobia until 1993, when it became a drastic reduction in cultural homophobia. And it's dropping every year amongst the general population. And most important, today's youth grow up virtually homophobia-free if they're white middle-class youth.
1993, what was so important?
1993, of course, you know, the United States set some of these precedents, right? And in 1992, at the end of 1992, this very charismatic guy ran for president by the name of Bill Clinton. And he played the saxophone, and he went on Saturday Night Live, and he was young, and he was cool, and he represented new ways of thinking, and he was very gay-friendly. In fact, you might recall that one of the platforms that the major platform that he brought was, I'm going to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the United States military. And this was a key directive, because by saying that I was going to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell for U.S. soldiers in the military, so openly gay soldiers could play in the military, which the military, of course, is very much so like sport, very masculine, right?
I don't think they play, but I know what you mean.
They do play, trust. Okay. By saying that we should allow gay soldiers to serve, it brought out all the stories of the currently serving gay male soldiers, and of course lesbian soldiers as well.
Are we going through that again?
We are. The difference between what happened back then and now is back then, of course, everybody was against it, but it was shocking to people to find out that, what? We have gay soldiers? We're kicking out 1,000 gay male soldiers a year? Are you, what? I didn't know that Marines can be gay. Today, we're having that debate again, and of course, very soon, I think the United States will allow gays to serve in the military. But nobody's having that argument. What? Gay soldiers? 80% of the American population supports it, and nobody's shocked by the fact that there are gay soldiers. So what this did in 1993 is it said that masculinity was not contingent upon sexuality. Gay men could be masculine, straight men could be feminine. And that began to unravel this whole coupling of heterosexuality with masculinity. It began to tell our society that it was false. It didn't exist. Then in 1998, gay marriage comes up in Hawaii and that brings up more cultural discourse. So I think it's very fair to say that the 1990s was a transition period.
And we'll get to the Hawaii thing soon, because that's directly reflected about what happened with the Proposition 8 in California recently. But
yes.
Greg Louganis in the 90s, the Olympic diver, came out, and he's the first, first sportsman on an international scale that we could, as young gay men, consider an icon or a mentor. He was the first international superstar of sport to come out.
He wasn't in theatre.
And he wasn't in theatre. he didn't run around the stage in costumes.
Yes.
He's perhaps the first international sports star, yes. There have been a handful of others throughout the years. Without question, there's been a... I forgot the name of the boxer. I apologize.
But again, it's an individual sport.
There was a baseball player in Los Angeles Dodgers named
Glenn
Burke.
Means nothing to us.
Yes, of course not. nor should it. And in the lesser sport of football, a guy named David Coppé came out, I believe, in 1977. I believe he came out of the closet. But there have been very few at the professional level, as you know. Of course, Ian Roberts here, and a select handful in the competitive team sports, which we will get to later.
Hold back, Dean.
But yes, he was sort of he was part of that transition.
In the 1990s, we're basically picking out a name here and a name there.
That's correct.
Now, so yes, things have changed, but yes, things are still not good enough, comfortable enough in our society that these sporting people can come out and say, yes, I'm gay.
And in the suburbs, that does not translate to acceptance. We're still seeing kids being bashed for being a little bit soft.
Now, you're not going to like me for saying this.
Probably not, but that's okay.
But gays and lesbians tend to be wedded to the victimization framework. We tend to be...
Tell that to the kid who's been bashed in the suburbs.
I understand that. And don't forget, I'm one who experienced that type of homophobia myself. But one doesn't make the case. And what's important to look at is the general trend. And the general trend is that homophobia has been on the incredibly rapid decline, culturally and institutionally, over the past 15 years. This means that fewer kids who come out of the closet are being bashed. There was a period in which more kids were coming out because there was less homophobia, and that meant so many more were coming out that more gay bashings were occurring, and it made it look like homophobia was on the rise, but it's not. I was giving a talk at a sexualities forum with a bunch of academics, and I was telling them about how homophobia is on the rise. I'm presenting my multiple studies to support this. And one woman stood up and said, this is in London, she said, what about Matthew Shepard? And I said, Matthew Shepard was an American in 1998. So what we tend to be good at is
picking
up...
Who was beaten to death.
Yes, and horribly, and it's a horrible situation, of course. But what we tend to be good at is hearing one story of homophobia and generalizing it to the populace, but not hearing dozens of stories of people who are out in their daily lives and have no issues in any capacity and generalizing that to the population. So this is the victimization framework. So what's important to do is to look at the sociological data. What is the average experience of openly gay athletes? What is the average experience of gay teenagers? And if you'd like, of course, we can discuss this.
All right. Now, I found in some of my reading here, and this was a program for Orgy, which I could find the heading right now. It's speaking about the unspoken. It was addressing homophobia in sport. Now, it was a Canadian program. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. And it's a really interesting piece. And it part of it says, take a walk in our shoes. And exactly saying what you were saying then. And basically, the comments frequently made about lesbian and gay men in order to give a better sense of the realities, they've been replaced with heterosexual. So these are the kind of comments that are on the polar end. So when did you decide to become a heterosexual? If you've never slept with a person of the same sex, how do you know you wouldn't prefer it? Or, so what do straight people do in bed anyhow? But you look so normal. You don't look heterosexual at all. So, but these are the normal kind of anti-comments, I guess, that would occur, well, that don't occur in the community. So although it may not be homophobia, there is that sense of underlying difference still within the community.
And by definition, we have to define ourselves differently.
Well, Yes, and I'm not saying I'm not advocating the lack of definition at all. Yeah. I'm not advocating that at all. In fact, I'm not advocating anything. I'm just telling you what the research shows.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, talk about your research. Your University of Bath, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, University of Bath in England, although I'm American, so that might be confusing.
It was
for some.
A little confusing with the accent at first.
We had this guy named George Bush. Did you ever hear of him?
No.
No, I never heard of him. Yeah. Did he play football?
Well, yeah, I think he was a cheerleader, actually, which is quite ironic. And he quite literally was. But after he was reappointed, my partner and I sought refuge in England. So
sensible.
Have
I think
equality.
A few people did from yes. the US. Yes.
Do you think that it is different in your research now through America, through the UK? Things were changing. You were talking about gay marriage in Central
Hawaii.
We're still fighting that battle here. Yes. In the UK, you know, you've got that possibility. So we feel that we are actually still a bit further back. Now, what does your research say?
Well, let's look at my research is mostly on sport, right? But I look at both gay men and straight men. And let me set up the research that I've done. So the first major research that I've done is between 1998 and about 2002, I interviewed 68 gay male athletes, 40 of which are out of the closet, 28 in the closet, to find out their experiences. And here I found that of the 40 who were out of the closet, not one had been beaten, not one had been berated, that they had all been accepted to some modicum on their teams, but there was still a culture of don't ask, don't tell with about 50% of them. And this tended to be more of the team sport athletes. So is that right? We know you're gay mate, but we don't want to talk about it. That was
sure.
the attitude.
Yep.
I followed that research up recently with some research that will hopefully be out quite soon with the same number of gay male athletes out of the closet in the United States, and found that this is decreasing now. So the athletes are coming out of the closet. Lesser capable athletes are coming out of the closet, and they're all having positive experiences, but there's much less don't ask, don't tell. It's very rare to hear don't ask, don't tell. What I find, and these are high school and university athletes, what I find amongst mostly white middle-class high school and university athletes, when they come out of the closet, they're accepted by their teammates. Their teammates actually say that it creates more cohesion on their teams because it gives them something to talk about. It gives them something to banter about.
And something to bond around.
And that is exactly what it is. It's disclosure brings disclosure. So I disclose something personal to you, you feel better about me. You disclose something personal to me, we bond.
In fact, it's the concept of enrollment is to allow someone into your own vulnerability.
Indeed.
And they will do the same.
Indeed, which is why the myth that if a gay athlete were to come out of the closet or a gay soldier were to come out, that it decreases team cohesion, it's not only myth, but it's wrong. The reality is it has the opposite effect in today's culture.
And I imagine would create a strengthening shell around the whole team framework if anyone from the outside dare be negative towards it.
You've read my book.
Oh, I'm about to light a candle and do some
kumbaya.
Kumbaya, my lord. Now, in the real world, okay, I might be completely wrong. You have done the studies. You've got the data. I have absolutely no data.
Yes.
But I have a perception. I have the perception that in Australia, if you're in a football team, you come out, you might be accepted per se, but you're going to be treated differently. People are going to look at you differently in the shower rooms. They're not going to let you in. We had recently the gay coach in Central Summer Australia somewhere. I can't remember his name.
In a Victorian football. A bisexual coach of a Victorian Aussie Rules football team was ostracised by not only his team but his township, and has subsequently been trying to fight that under equal opportunity laws ever since.
Yes.
Not to much success.
So my picture is, I guess, different to the data that you have.
Now, it's very important to understand that my data is collected in the United States and the United Kingdom. And between the two, and I have much more data we should talk about, I think that your listeners would find very interesting, including heterosexual men kissing in England at 89%.
That's a
we'll get to that
whole
one, right?
Different
don't,
book.
Put don't that one down there. Ahead like Dean
put
does.
That one down on your put that one down on your list. But in the United Kingdom, things are much better than in the United States. But even in the United States, this is the common mantra that I hear. It's my perception, I believe, and what we tend to do is we tend to base it our feelings, our understandings of the culture from how we experienced it when we were youth in high school or university playing sport. We need the research. the research hasn't been done here in Australia. Caroline Simmons, a good friend of mine, has sponsored some of the research that I believe you spoke about earlier. And that shows that there is some progress. It shows that matters are split. I think it's probably fair to say that if Australia is behind the United States, and yes, I hope it isn't, but if it is, if this kangaroo country is behind the United States, you're just experiencing cultural lag. And you can look to the United States to see what's going to happen in the near future here.
And I think more than likely you are right. We're speaking to Dr. Eric Anderson. He is addressing a conference tomorrow and the next day, actually, regarding homophobia in sport. He is a sociologist and researcher, a worldwide expert on footy players and poofs. You're with Dean Beck and Sue Wilkinson across the Community Radio Network.
And we are talking to Dr. Eric Anderson from the University of Bath about sport and homophobia. Now, prior to that, we were talking about the culture and the perceptions of, you know, the boys in the locker rooms and the showers. Is there a locker room culture in your research? What have you found?
It's changing.
What's with the whole slapping on the ass thing and flicking towels, and they're all naked together and having showers together, and they're embracing each other on the footy field and kissing and carrying on? What's going on? They're
most of that
more
is
gay
media
than us.
Most of that is television. That's not the way it really happens. There's a lot of sexual talk in the locker room, but for the most part, they go in, they shower, they're chatting, they get out of there. It's not a whole big sort of love fest like that. But what's most important to understand is how gay men are in those locker rooms today, and that is, it's not an issue for them. At least the gay men that I've researched, and also I do ethnography, so I'll go out with these heterosexual football teams, including in incredibly conservative states in America. So we're not just looking at New York and the United States and
the California, Bible Belt,
the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
And I'm out there doing the research on the team. If they drink, I drink. If they're playing football, I'm playing football, and I stay with them 24 hours a day, well, 16 hours a day. I go into the locker rooms with them as well. And I've talked to openly gay athletes who are in the locker rooms with them as well. And this just doesn't seem to be an issue. The youth today just don't really care about it. The attitude has gone from, oh my God, I don't want a gay guy in the locker room because he might be checking me out, to, if he is checking me out, I hope he likes what he sees.
I would say the same thing in the inner suburban area here in Melbourne is very, very similar. Under about 28, 25 years of age,
yes,
I don't think race is as big an issue as we think it is, and I don't think homophobia is as big an issue as we think it is. In fact, I'm delighted when I see young people from clearly very different cultural backgrounds arm in arm, and it seems to happen more and more, and you see it on the trams and on the trains. And I believe that things like our radio station here helps young people to come out, and we have some rather progressive high schools that encourage and have a no-tolerance attitude towards homophobia in their high schools. So I do think that things are changing here. But
it's still in the media. We're still talking about it. We've still got Jason Ankermankis, who came out the other month and said, don't come out.
If you look at what athletes would have said about gays in sport 10 years ago, somebody like Jason Ankermankis, and I don't know him, I'm not I don't follow Australian sports too much.
Neither do we.
But it's because they're not very exciting.
He's call yourself an expert.
So he can only run. Pow, pow.
What he would have said 10 years ago and what the media would have said about a gay athlete 10 years ago has changed. So his comment was basically, I don't have a problem with it, but don't come out because it might be difficult for you. Well, that's actually kind of a feminist position, isn't it? I'm a bit worried about you. It used to be, I don't want you. There's no room for you in my locker room. No faggots on this team.
But what wouldn't it have been better if he'd actually said the culture in the football system, it's going to be tough for anybody to come out, but I'll back you if you do. Wouldn't have that been a much more supportive comment rather than, oh, I'm going to sit on the fence and pretend that I'm really lovely and I'm a happy person and I'm going to look after you. Rubbish, I say.
Yes, of course it would be much better. And I think it shows that you're in transition. At that level of sport, you're in transition.
I think it's sad, sorry, Dean, that, you know, that you do have somebody who, the best thing that he did actually is the fact that everybody's talking about it now and people going, you're just such an idiot, you know, that's great. And we got a lot of conversation around it. But there's still that lack, and Aussie rules, we are still waiting for one person to come out.
Indeed. So, and we were lucky enough on this very show, on our first episode of this very show, to have one of Australia's most elite swimmers, Daniel Kowalski, talk about his recent coming out experience. And he, like you suggest, had virtually no negativity towards him following his coming out. Brilliant. And a role model for all Australians.
So why the lack? What, if the data supports that it's becoming less and we're transitioning and all those great, lovely candle lighting things, why is it still so minimal?
This is the million-dollar question.
Thank you.
The question is, why is it I find openly gay athletes at the high school level, the university level, community levels, I find them thriving, coming out in increasing numbers? Now, that's not to say that you can throw a stone and hit one. They're not that common, but sure, you know, they are coming out. Why is it they're not coming out at the professional level? We may be on the cusp in the United Kingdom of this happening. We just had somebody come out in the very masculine sport of hurling. I know it sounds like something you do after a Friday night.
We do know that well.
Okay. And we just had Gareth Thomas come out in rugby. Very masculine sport, coming out while actively playing. This is a difference. They used to come out after playing. So we can no longer say in England, why aren't they coming out? Well, they have. They're beginning to. There are many multiple factors as to why athletes don't come out of the closet at professional level. But basically, when you went back and when you said earlier in the hour about how sport is like a fraternity, it's like a military, or it's like, I forgot what else you said, prisons. The difference is between the military and a prison is youth are indoctrinated into sport from the time they're very young. They're very good at throwing or kicking the ball. They get rewarded by that. Their parents praise them. Community praises them. They move up the ladder. The better they get, the more attention they get, the more they identify as an athlete, the more they focus on their athletic abilities. But the one thing about an athlete, unlike somebody who decides to become a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher, is that one misstep and it's all taken away. One poor play and it's gone.
I asked Daniel Kowalski, who was always seemed to come in his professional career second. He never quite got there to be the gold Olympic medalist, for example. I asked him, do you think that if you had been true to yourself, been your authentic self, that would have given you that extra edge in your sport?
And I find that it does. When athletes come out of the closet, and I think Canadian gold medalist in swimming, I can't remember his name right off the head, and he's a friend of mine. Apologize.
Not your friend anymore.
Once, yes, exactly. He's got a great book, the whole bit. Once he came out of the closet, he improved. Most of the athletes I talk to say that.
Well, Dr. Eric Anderson.
Oh, you're not going to let the 89% go, are you?
No. Nope.
Do you have time for it?
Yeah,
quickly.
Of course we do.
Okay. Matters have progressed so far in England that in my studies of two universities in England, 89% of heterosexual male undergraduates are now kissing each other on the lips as a form of saying, I love you. They don't do it to just every male. It's not like shaking hands. It's more exuberant than that. And it's not always drunk. But it's a way of saying, I love you, man. You're my brother. They kiss each other on the lips. And what that has done, of course, is open it up for gay men to kiss in dance clubs as well. So now the dance clubs are becoming integrated. You see two men kissing. You don't know whether they're gay men or whether they're straight men, unless, of course, they're making out. And straight men are now cuddling to some degree. They're holding each other. They're embracing each other. And this is what happens
more
when homophobia dies.
Yeah, I
agree with that. I think just in the general community. But walking down the street in Melbourne, you are very, very unlikely to see two men holding hands. But go to the St Kilda suburb.
Give it a couple of years, love. You'll be right.
I was doing it this morning.
We've been speaking to Dr. Eric Anderson. He is addressing a conference titled The Worlds of Football, Triumphs, Trials and Traumas. It's being held here in Melbourne by the Victoria University, and you can check out more through the Victoria University website. You can also find out more about Dr. Eric Anderson's many books addressing masculinity and homophobia and sport. You can check that out at ericandersonphd.com. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I'm trying to be very nice. I'm going to be very polite and not say anything else right
You've been listening to Word for Word. You'll hear a podcast of this interview available from joy.org.au. I'm Dean Beck.
And I'm Sue Wilkinson. Thank you for your time.
Till next week. Bye for now.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Brierley and presented by Dean Beck, Sue Wilkinson and Tim Newton.
Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLB TIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.